Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Just one guest today, the political scientist Adam Hilton, talking about the modern history and structure of the Democratic Party, about which people talk a lot, but not always knowledgeably. Before that, a few words about the state of the U.S. economy. It is undeniably recovering from its COVID-induced crisis. Unequally, for sure, but this is the USA. A major reason for that recovery, though, is not normal USA fare. The massive flows of federal cash to households provided by the CARES Act, passed early in the crisis, and the American Rescue Plan Act, passed just after Biden took office. Together, those provided about $1.5 trillion in cash that kept a lot of people from absolute desperation, and helped stimulate an economic recovery from what a year ago looked like a very dark moment. While some households spent all that money, the better off saved it. From the second quarter of last year into the first quarter of this, households saved over 18% of their income, more than twice the 2019 average. With travel, restaurants, and a lot of retail outlets shut down, there are fewer things to spend money on, for those, that is, who had money. That means there's a reservoir of over $2 trillion in savings that people will probably spend in the coming months. The rest of the year is likely to see a powerful economic boom of a sort we haven't seen since the early 1980s, or maybe even the immediate post-World War II years. What should we conclude from this? Among other things, large-scale fiscal stimulus really works in the short term. It both alleviates want and stimulates conventional economic growth. And it's massively popular politically. If the fiscal and social investments Biden has proposed, which also earn 60% approval ratings, are passed in something like their current form, that would lay the groundwork for a longer-term, more sustainable boom. Not eco-socialism by any means, but a lot better than nothing. But the pandemic is still leaving economic scars. On Thursday morning, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York released a study showing that over a third of small businesses that closed during the pandemic haven't reopened and may never reopen. Their workers will not be recalled. We're going to hear a lot of stories of economic recovery in the coming weeks and months, and while they are rooted in reality, they run the risk of effacing this sort of lingering damage, and of discouraging support for the longer-term physical and social investment needed to support a less unequal, less environmentally destructive economy. Behind the News will stay on top of these issues. And now on to the Democratic Party. What is it exactly? On the left, it's easy to see it as a well-oiled machine that grinds progressive politics into dust. There's some truth to this for sure, but is it the party itself or the quest for power and the compromises that dictates that fuel the destruction? Today's guest, Adam Hilton, argues that the Democratic Party is in fact very weakly structured. Anyone can run in its primaries and, if successful, take office. There's almost no organizational or ideological discipline. You can't say quite the same about the Republican Party, which looks like it's largely under the personal control of Donald Trump, but it's not a foregone conclusion how long that personality cult will last. How did all this come to be? Adam Hilton has some answers. Hilton, an assistant professor of politics at Mount Holyoke, is just out with True Blues, The Contentious Transformation of the Democratic Party, published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. The book reviews the history of internal conflict within the Democratic Party from the New Deal onward, tracing its transformation from a party with a substantial constituency of Southern racist reactionaries in the 1930s to one with a substantial progressive constituency today. How did that happen? Here's Adam Hilton with some answers. Let's begin by talking just about American parties in general. To a lot of people abroad, the American party system is a very strange thing. The relative absence of structure and discipline, and certainly participation by membership, seems strange. So how do American parties stand up compared to those abroad?
Well, American parties are really exceptional. They might be, without exaggerating or buying into American exceptionalism as a ideology, American political parties are perhaps the most exceptional part of our political system. We have the strictness of the two parties. Not only are there just two, but they've been the same two parties, at least in name, since the Civil War. And that's pretty remarkable.
With almost a quasi-legal standing, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Even though the Constitution makes no mention of them at all. Political parties developed organically, quite quickly, even within the the class of the founders, if you want to put it that way, as they began. They were not fond of parties. Madison penned his very famous denunciation of factions. George Washington, in his farewell address, denounced the spirit of party. And yet, nevertheless, within a generation, Hamilton and Jefferson and Adams found themselves on opposing sides of some major political issues, and they began mobilizing coalitions to try and outcompete the other.
One difference is, which you point out, that in Europe, the franchise was quite restricted, where in the U.S., it was, from the early on, fairly broad. If you're a white man, the right to vote was far more widely enjoyed than it was in Europe. What did that do to the evolution of the party systems in the two regions?
Yeah, we could frame this as, in Europe, given the restricted status for many Europeans of lacking full citizenship rights, lacking the ability to participate, we could think of them building political parties out in society, right? Organizations of social classes, working class parties, middle class parties, sometimes Christian parties around religious groupings, and sort of trying to use them to break into the political system, to mobilize the masses. And often what they were trying to contest was they wanted the right to vote. They wanted the right to be able to select their representatives. In the United States, you have almost the exact reverse happening. Is, like I mentioned before, the framers and some of the founding generation, they began forming small cliques and correspondence committees among themselves. And then to out-mobilize their opponents, they went out. It was a kind of outward dynamic. They reached out from the state into society to try and mobilize followings around this or that candidate, this or that platform, in order to try and win elections. And it was that early extension of suffrage to white men that made the critical difference.
Now let's turn to the Democratic Party. One could do a similar book to what you did on the Republican Party, but that's not what you did. You focused almost exclusively on the Democrats. So let's start the clock in the 1930s and the 1940s, when the Democratic Party was an uneasy coalition, it became increasingly uneasy over the decades, of urban working class and the associated political machines, and then Southern white racists. Aside from the internal tensions of the party, what does that say about the party structure in general, the degree of autonomy enjoyed within the party? It says, it suggests not much discipline.
No, very little discipline and quite a lot of autonomy for those state party affiliates. In fact, there was a lot of controversy over the degree of autonomy within the party. We had, you saw from through the 1940s, the 1950s, the 1960s, all the way up to about the historic realignment of the parties along racial issues. Throughout that whole 30-year period, you saw repeated clashes within the Democratic Party, often around party platforms or nominations or conventions, where urban union-oriented liberals resented the fact that they were sharing the same party label with Southern conservatives in the Jim Crow South, right, coming from, you know, what Robert Mickey in his book would call authoritarian enclaves. So they didn't face any party competition at all. But they could win election on the Democratic Party ticket. They could caucus together in Congress and basically sabotage the liberal platforms that were being written and being endorsed by presidential candidates like FDR or Harry Truman or Adlai Stevenson or John F. Kennedy.
There was, of course, that walkout by the Dixiecrats at the 48 convention because Hubert Humphrey was pushing civil rights too hard. But, you know, the party managed to stumble through the 50s. But tensions got really, really serious by the 60s. The social movements of the 60s, especially civil rights, but, you know, later women's movement, gay movement, really took it to the breaking point, right?
Yeah, and quite literally broke it open. For those of you who don't know it, but for many of your listeners who even just have an inkling of what I mean when I say Chicago 1968, is the images come up of a party in complete chaos. The 1968 Democratic Convention, many of these tensions inside the party between racial liberals and civil rights advocates and the Dixiecrat South, and also, of course, by 1968, between, you know, liberal anti-war doves and the cold warrior hawkish Democrats, all these forces came to a head, and the convention was mired in chaos. Violence broke out on the floor of the convention. Huge amounts of violence broke out in the streets as Chicago's famous machine mayor Richard Daley unleashed the Chicago Riot Police and the National Guard on demonstrators. It was a catastrophe, and the party was plunged into complete chaos. It was, as Hubert Humphrey put it at the time, as if the entire environment of politics had fallen apart.
And you point to Daley. Certainly, we tend to look at this as a North-South conflict, or a fight with the Dixiecrats, but also the urban machines were on the conservative side of things.
Yeah, they generally were. They were on multiple sides, depending on which issue. The urban machines, while usually what we would not call racial liberals, were cognizant of the rising numbers, the in-migration of African Americans out of the South since the Great Migration, beginning around the First World War, but accelerating sharply during the Great Depression and the Second World War. So the electoral calculus in many large industrial states like Illinois or New York or Pennsylvania and some others began to shift as they started to try to court black voters and move them away from their historical home with the party of Lincoln into the party of Roosevelt. But then on many other issues, such as so-called cultural issues like the countercultural kind of hippie movement, women's liberation, and then especially on the foreign policy issue around the Vietnam War, the machines were often dead set against the liberal wing of the party.
Now, that 68 crisis led to some soul searching in the party, but also some major organizational renovation over a fairly short period of time. How did it happen, and what did it look like when the party reemerged in 72?
Yeah, well, one of the things this book tries to do is understand the interplay between moments of party crisis and party change. And one of the things that the mobilization of the movements of the late 1960s did is they created enough chaos inside the party that a relatively small group of party reformers were able to propose and enact pretty far-reaching structural changes to the party that had dramatic effects on the party in a relatively short period of time. And so between 1968 and 72, the party fully transformed how it selected presidential nominees, basically enacting what used to be a process pretty monopolized by what we might call party elites into the binding sequence of primaries that we're pretty familiar with now. That basically democratized the process so that party members or average rank and file Democrats could participate in selecting who that nominee would be. This would be a way of trying to work out some compromise candidates sometimes. And when those new rules were enacted, George McGovern, who had been a spokesperson for the reform movement, maneuvered his way into capturing the nomination in 1972. He was a prominent anti-war candidate. The 1972 platform, written by George McGovern, called for a massive redistribution of wealth and power in the United States. A lot of people in the party freaked out because they were they thought they were witnessing the takeover of the Democratic Party by the left.
Well, one of the things they did was reduce the number of old white guys at the convention to really, really change the demographics of the people who handed out the nominations.
Yeah, and in addition to just reforming the nomination process to depend more on the primary elections, they implemented pretty stringent affirmative action guidelines. And so, yeah, between 1968 and 1972, the convention delegates, the people who assemble and hand out the nomination, that went from being a overwhelmingly middle-aged, middle-class group of white guys to being a fairly representative picture or cross-section of the United States. Lots of women, lots of people of color, LGBTQ activists, lots of young people, lots of working class people with below median incomes. It was a party turned upside down.
I'm speaking with Adam Hilton, author of True Blues, The Contentious Transformation of the Democratic Party, just out from the University of Pennsylvania Press. And I notice you use one of your chapter epigraphs, one of my favorite quotes, the AFL-CIO guy who said at the 72 convention, too much hair and not enough cigars.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And what is ironic about the observation and the general abhorrence that most of the AFL-CIO leaders felt about this transformation is that the actual number of union members attending the delegation increased. So there was actually more union presence in the 72 convention than there was in 68. The problem was that they weren't under the control of George Meany. They were dedicated to voting for the candidate that had won in the primaries rather than been selected in the proverbial smoke-filled back rooms.
And of course, Meany had the AFL-CIO pretty much sit out that election. There's talk he even preferred Nixon win. It was about the war. It was about these cultural changes within the party. What was driving this union antipathy to the Democratic Party of 72?
Yeah, well, previous people who have looked at this have come to different conclusions. Some have said, okay, it was a cultural thing. Is Meany and many of the older white males that were running the AFL-CIO were very culturally conservative. They thought the anti-Vietnam War movement was unpatriotic. They were thought it was a bunch of spoiled hippies. They really didn't have many nice things to say about the women's movement, let alone the LGBTQ movement, nascent though it was. Others have said, that this was about foreign policy and McGovern was deemed to be too soft on communism. But really what I found when I looked really deeply into this and I kind of poured through a lot of the AFL-CIO archives is the AFL-CIO leadership was extremely upset because they had developed what leverage they had in the Democratic Party since the 1930s in those smoke-filled back rooms that the reform movement had dismantled in the course of democratizing the presidential nominating process. And one of the reasons you can kind of come to this conclusion is while Meany, AFL-CIO president, and many other leaders were pretty upset by this, many other unions were not, because they had never actually enjoyed much pride of place or had much of a seat at the table in those smoke-filled back rooms. Meany had really monopolized that process. And so AFSCME, a lot of the public sector unions, a lot of the service unions, a lot of unions that had many younger, especially people of color and women as members, they actually were all pretty positive about this reform of the Democratic Party because they thought they actually might be able to finally get a seat at the table now that the labor barons and the bosses of the AFL-CIO had sort of been overthrown in the process.
It's interesting. Some of those splits are still visible today, really. So McGovern got crushed, one of the greatest landslides in the history of American presidential politics. So the counter-revolutionaries came in and wanted to undo some of those reforms, right? What did they do in the after the 72?
Yeah, their analysis of this was fairly sophisticated. Again, similar to what many of your listeners have probably experienced or even participated in the aftermath of 2016, when there is a major defeat of a party, whether that's a surprising, though narrow defeat, or a landslide blowout in the case of McGovern in 72, there's a lot of recriminations that go on afterwards. There's a lot of finger pointing, there's a lot of what if, or there's a lot of been, or there's a lot of we should have done this or nominated this person. But in the aftermath of that 72 blowout, the folks like the AFL-CIO leadership, like the Cold Warriors and the foreign policy hawks that had been disturbed by the rise of the anti-war movement in the Democratic Party, and a lot of other kind of culturally conservative folks, they seized on McGovern's defeat as an opportunity to push back and roll back some of the reforms. Between 68 and 72, they had just not had a very good, compelling way of countering the reformers. The reformers seemed to have the obvious facts on their side, that the party was in terrible crisis, something needed to be done. And the party was plunged into such a crisis that stakeholders in the existing order of things simply did not have much in the way of defense. There was no way to really justify the old system of choosing presidential nominees in smoke-filled back rooms. So McGovern's defeat gives the counter-reformers the rationale they finally needed, or that they had lacked before. They could now say that these reforms produced an unrepresentative nominee who was rejected by the electorate, and if we don't change the nominating system again, the Democrats will never retake the presidency.
It's interesting how they appropriated some of that rhetoric of representation.
Yeah, you know, I mean, to employ a more contemporary phrase, they really flipped the script. They began targeting the reformers as being anti-democratic, as being elitist, as being unrepresentative, as if the old system, monopolized by fairly stodgy, white, middle-class, older men, had somehow not been elitist or much more representative. But they certainly try to steal that rhetoric back, that what they want to do is the real democratization of the party. And over the next, in the ensuing years between 1972 and 1976, the counter-reformers score some pretty important victories on limiting the extent to which the reformers are in control of the party.
So they nominated Jimmy Carter in 1976, one of the more conservative Democratic presidents. Was that what they wanted, or was he something of a surprise?
He was a surprise. I mean, the better way to put it is Jimmy Carter nominated himself. Carter was a marginal figure in national politics. He was a former governor of Georgia. He was not a bigwig in politics. But what he was able to do was he was able to take advantage of this new nominating system with the media attention that began for surprise underdog winners of, you know, an early contest such as Iowa or New Hampshire. And he was basically able to circumvent the party. Carter was not a reformer. The reformers were lukewarm about him. And by the end of his presidency, no one was happy with him, of course.
Now everybody loves him, but everybody hated him back then. The counter-revolutionaries were not able to change the nominating system to the degree that the professionals were back in charge, the party hacks are back in charge. Carter was able to come as this outsider and win through this fairly open nominating process.
Exactly, right. What the counter-reformers are very successful at was blunting what was the remaining items on the reformers' agenda. Had George McGovern won, which, you know, is a bit of an extreme thought experiment, or even if the counter-reformers had not successfully mobilized in the wake of McGovern's loss, the reformers still had the wind in their sails. They still had the momentum behind them. They had a lot of other plans. They wanted to build a much more revitalized national party structure. Basically, they wanted to make the Democratic Party into a much more robust and institutionally integrated, a more well-organized liberal programmatic party.
Yeah, well, they wanted more ideological organization as well as institutional organization.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they had basically what they saw themselves doing is trying to extend programmatic liberalism beyond its New Deal limits, right? Beyond the limits that the New Deal had run into, primarily because of Southern Democrats trying to block what remained of FDR's program, with assistance from Republicans, of course. But at the same time, they wanted to enact some pretty novel developments in American party history. They wanted to have midterm party conferences, where these are much more common across the pond in European social democratic parties, where the leadership has to appear before the assembled delegates of the party base, the party activists, account for their time in office, usually face some heckling for failing to do this or that that they had promised in the party platform. They wanted a dues-paying membership. They wanted much more media organization. They wanted the party to sort of have its own newspaper and its ability to implement and devise robust programs. All of that was on the agenda, and the counter-reformers successfully blocked all of that. That's what they were really able to do. What they were not able to do was roll back the clock on the primary nominating system that we know now. And so Carter was able to exploit that. because so many states had to change their state laws to conform with these recommendations that the reformers came up with, the Republican Party ended up adopting the same system too. It was just easier for parties in states to adopt the same nominating procedures. And so, way down the road, what happened between 1968 and 72 is partly also how we could understand Donald Trump was able to circumnavigate or circumvent the party establishment in his bid for the nomination in 2016.
And one thing that these reformers within the Democratic Party were looking at was something like national economic planning. And they had their hearts set on a full employment bill, the Humphrey-Hawkins bill. Carter watered that down. What happened? What does that tell us about the nature of control in the party?
Yeah, Carter, I mean, watered it down is a nice way to put it. Carter hollowed it out. The push for full employment is an interesting one. It came at a moment when, generally speaking, both parties were in the midst of a major realignment. The solid Democratic South was beginning to become the solid Republican South. The parties were realigning on racial politics, and in a wider sense, the whole political economy was plunged into the myriad crises of the 1970s between oil price hikes, stagflation, the collapse of the international monetary system. So in this period, people on the right and left are groping for possible answers. Keynesian instruments of economic policy don't seem to make sense anymore. And in that moment, many of these reformers and other allies in the trade unions took advantage of the crisis to try and reintroduce some of the lost legacy of the New Deal about economic planning and planning for full employment. That became a galvanizing demand across the party, across the Democratic Party. It was one of the centerpieces of the 1976 Democratic platform. Carter vaguely endorsed it, and the party had an opportunity, one of these midterm policy conferences, one of the few that ever took place, to hold his feet to the fire on it. What this episode has to teach us about who holds power in American political parties is despite the fact that interest groups, social movements, advocacy organizations have grown in such prominence and play such larger roles in American party politics than they did several generations ago, they are still pretty reliant on office holders choosing to either give in to their demands or resist them. There's very few enforcement mechanisms. And so what we saw with Carter and his hollowing out of the full employment policy was one of these instances where Carter decided it wasn't a good idea. The party had a large coalition pushing him to enact it. So he enacted a completely toothless, symbolic policy that took the wind out of the sails of the reformers, but substantively did very little to bring the country towards full employment.
What was motivating Carter? Was it business pressure? Was it his own instinctive conservatism? What was driving his opposition?
I think there were a myriad of concerns. When you look at the White House memos going back and forth between Carter and his domestic policy advisors, there are some who are pressing him on, you know, the business community is going to react with horror to this kind of thing. Others simply wanted to prioritize the fight against inflation, which especially, you know, by 77, 78, it was approaching double digits and was pushing unemployment out of the picture as the primary concern. It also was simply, it was a very bold and comprehensive policy. It would have required wage and price controls, which the unions were internally divided over. They usually see it more as wage controls rather than controls on profits. And I think Carter's instinctive conservatism also held him back from embracing something like this. So I don't think there was any one smoking gun that did it in. It was a very bold policy. He was not a bold president. And the episode really illustrated the incapacity of these policy demanders, of these organized groups and their almost movement-like mobilization, their inability to really hold his feet to the fire on it.
Yeah, I remember, I think it was one year, was it 79 or 80, where he issued three budgets. He was really confused about what he was going to do.
Yeah.
That was the first part of my interview with Adam Hilton, author of True Blues, The Contentious Transformation of the Democratic Party, just out from the University of Pennsylvania Press. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. That was some of Ronald Reagan by the Swedish punk band Chartist 77. And now on to part two of my interview with Adam Hilton, author of True Blues, The Contentious Transformation of the Democratic Party, from the University of Pennsylvania Press. Hilton describes the trauma of the 1980 election. I have vivid memories of that myself. In a former life, working for a medical publisher, I was on a business trip to Atlanta during that election. I recall ordering room service and settling in for a long night of watching the returns. Instead, Reagan was declared the victor almost immediately. I was stunned. I rode the elevator up to the rooftop bar and drank tequila, trying to cope with the shock of the reactionary actor, whom people on the left had dismissed as a comical idiot, taking power. I took a picture of myself the next morning in the airport photo booth, and between the tequila and the electoral shock, I looked like someone who'd been seriously traumatized. I had no conscious idea at the time that Reagan's politics would dominate the scene for decades to come, but judging from the expression of my face, I must have had some instinctive notion of the horrors that were about to ensue. And now back to Adam Hilton. So the 1980 election, harsh defeat for the Democrats, Reagan wins, ushers in a whole new era in politics in the U.S., but also had a strong influence on global politics. What happened within the Democratic Party that defeat?
This defeat was, I think many people forget, really dramatic. Almost what some people at the time called a traumatizing defeat for the Democratic Party. This was the first Democratic president, to lose re-election since 1888. So it had nearly been 100 years since a sitting Democratic president had lost re-election. Now, that's because some were assassinated in office, some chose not to run again. But that was really quite dramatic. The capture of the Senate for the first time since the 50s was a big deal. And so this, again, sent a signal through the party that mobilized a new faction of Democrats to conclude that, look, activists are just in way too much control in this party. If we can reestablish some kind of control over the nominating system, if we can reestablish control over the platform and policy making, we might stand a chance at winning re-election. And that feeling, which was being registered in 1980, only became more pronounced through that dismal decade for the Democrats as they went on to lose in another landslide blowout in 1984, another quasi-landslide blowout in 1988. By that time, everyone agreed that something was wrong in the party. The question was who was going to be able to mobilize to do something about it.
And this was the era when Al Fromm and the DLC and then eventually Bill Clinton were on the rise.
Exactly. Yeah. Al Fromm founded and got the Democratic Leadership Council, the DLC, off the ground in this period, eventually installing Bill Clinton as its chair. And they went on an ideas blitz. They tried a number of tactics. They tried to take over the DNC. That didn't work. They tried to reform the nominating process by introducing what we've come to know as superdelegates. That didn't help the party win re-election either. And eventually they settled on a presidential strategy, is if they themselves could actually take advantage and dominate the new nominating process that had been introduced by reformers, they might be able to seize the presidency and from there remake the party.
Well, they did in 92 with Bill Clinton, who, of course, was also an exceptionally talented politician. It wasn't just the program. He was a very charismatic character who was really good at politics. But as you point out, and I kind of forgot this, but the early Bill Clinton years were not out of the DLC playbook.
Yeah, part of what I'm trying to do in this particular part of the book is, in general, I feel like we have a narrative that actually tends to exaggerate the power of the quote-unquote new Democrats and the DLC. We toss around words like party hegemony and the neoliberalization of the party. And I think those are pretty useful terms to an extent. But the DLC and the new Democrats had a lot more trouble than I think we tend to remember. And I think their legacy is much more limited than we usually believe. And one of the things that they came into office thinking they were going to do was that they were going to transform the party. I mean, yes, they had particular policy ideas about, you know, free trade and financial liberalization and other things that were really important and that had really important effects on the party and American public policy. But one of their partisan project was to purge the party of what they called liberal fundamentalism. And that, I think, they actually had quite a lot of trouble doing. In Bill Clinton's first 2 years, the DLC playbook basically went right out the window because he was governing not alone. He was governing with a Democratic Congress that was well to his left. And for the first 2 years, he found himself taking up issues that drove Al Frome and other people just crazy for promoting Don't Ask, Don't Tell, for pursuing healthcare reform rather than welfare reform. And these kinds of things. And once that cost the Democrats control of the House in 1994, in the Gingrich Revolution, the DLC actually viewed it as a victory because now they knew that they could play the liberal Democrats off against the conservative Republicans and the DLC's centrist agenda could gain some traction in Congress.
But it took the Republican Congress for the DLC to get its policy agenda adopted.
Exactly, right. And they were able to sell it as, hey, Democrats, this is how we'll undercut the popularity of these Gingrich Republicans, is if we steal some of the items from their agenda, like, say, welfare reform or some social conservatism issues on whether there's, you know, there's too much profanity in rap music or something, you know, something like that. But really, if you look, almost all those items were on the DLC agenda well before they won the presidency in 1992. So it was just a window of opportunity for them to push their own agenda.
Now, fast forward to the Obama years. He won election in the midst of a massive economic crisis. Then, you know, he passed the large stimulus package, and then 3 months later, he's on the phone to Thomas Friedman talking about cutting entitlements. So what about how Obama governed and his relation to the Democratic Party?
Well, Obama was rather aloof of the party. Obama not only he did a couple of things. He governed as what he called a fierce advocate for the Democratic Party, rather than trying to resist and purge the party of many of its activist groups and its association with social movements in the way that the Clintonian New Democrats tried to do. Obama embraced many of them, especially rhetorically, right? He could really speak to those causes, whether that was gun control issues, eventually LGBTQ issues. Obviously, the issue of civil rights was paramount.
But he's always afraid to talk about race. I mean, he's really avoided the topic for much of his presidency.
Yeah, he certainly did try and avoid it, especially in terms of when it meant really doing much about it.
He was great with the words, but the deeds.
He was great with the words, and one of his techniques was to offer his own biography as this way of narrating a story of American peoplehood that involves this diversity and a progressive, almost inevitable bending of the arc of the universe towards justice. It wasn't a direct way of talking about race, but it was a way of packaging all these distinct activist concerns together into one kind of narrative. And one of the remarkable things about the Obama presidency is the way he actually organizationally built a vehicle to orchestrate his relationships with the activist space of the party. So one of the things he did that no one had ever done before is he left his campaign organization active between elections, and he actually spun it off as a personal advocacy organization that would keep in contact with the, what is it, 2.2 million volunteers he had recruited into his 2008 campaign, the many millions of email addresses he had, and the many millions of tweets he would send out. And he actually kept these folks active in a way where they felt they could get a lot of their issue priorities heard, and Obama would reflect them back to them. But at the same time, he could keep them mobilized to try and promote his own agenda. So he had them blitzing Congress with calls to push the Affordable Health Care Act through. He had them lobbying senators for the confirmation of Supreme Court justices. Obama built himself a kind of an activist organization that reflected back a lot of the key concerns and groups that are animating Democratic Party politics, but in an organization that he was in control in.
But under him, the Democratic Party lost massive amounts of power at the state and local level, just bloodletting at the sub-presidential level. And he didn't really seem to care very much about that. A sharp contrast with Republican presidents before Trump, who were very concerned with building up the party at the low levels.
Absolutely right. Is we've seen a persistent pattern in both parties over the last 50, 60 years or so, where Democratic presidents have usually looked at their party organization, at the DNC, at state and local level organizations, as things for them to exploit for their own reelection or promoting their own agenda. Republican presidents, on the contrary, have usually invested huge amounts of resources in building these things up over time. And so Obama's personal advocacy organization was symptomatic of this, even if it was innovative. This organization that he built that went through a few iterations, variously called Organizing for Obama, Organizing for America, Organizing for Action, which is still up and running today, he spun it out of the DNC. It had no formal connection to the Democratic Party at all. It was his organization, and it promoted his reelection and his agenda. And obviously, while it came to his assistance in 2012, it did not have any spillover benefits for Democrats down ticket, who, as you mentioned, were simply just gutted over his tenure in office.
I'm speaking with Adam Hilton, author of True Blues, The Contentious Transformation of the Democratic Party, just out from the University of Pennsylvania Press. And your book ends before the 2020 election. I think you got maybe a couple of words in, but nothing of any significance. What are your thoughts on watching the early Biden presidency governing with more than a little bit of Bernie Sanders? Are you surprised by this, or how do you read what's going on, and how is this in relation to the Democratic Party?
Well, I think this is happening because of many of the transformations in the Democratic Party that are documented in the book. While those reformers back in the 1960s did not get to see many of elements of their vision come to fruition, what did end up emerging, notwithstanding the efforts of the Clintons and other new Democrats in the 1990s, is what has emerged is a very progressive, almost unified Democratic Party. There are outliers there. There's Abigail Spanberger. There's Joe Manchin, and Kristen Sinema, and we can look at those. But overall, especially if you look at the party platforms of the last 12 years or so, they have been moving in a solidly progressive direction for a long time, especially on issues of economic redistribution. And of course, in a much more broadly inclusive vision about who deserves economic redistribution than the kind of platforms we saw in the 30s or 40s, say. So I think what's happening now is a reflection of where the activist base of the party is. The activist base of the party has been moving to the left for a while on many issues. And I think Biden, as, if you will, a consistent centrist, has been moving to the left too. I don't know if we should be that surprised that this happens with folks like this. I mean, he's not representing Delaware anymore. Now he represents the entire country. Now he's the leader of the Democratic Party. And I think anyone who's put in that position has to reposition themselves to reflect those constituencies. But then, of course, we also have the crisis, right? The crisis has provided Biden with a moment to be bold. And I don't just mean the pandemic, right? The pandemic is its own kind of crisis that requires federal response. But when you listen to what Biden said, even just the other night in his address to the joint session of Congress, is there's a crisis of democracy as he sees it, right? He wants to convince people, like FDR did in the 1930s, that democracy, or what we might call capitalist democracy, liberal democracy, works, right? Because now there are competing alternatives out there now. Maybe not autocratic China as an alternative, but the illiberal democracy and that we know is on the rise in many European countries, and that we saw with Donald Trump and the insurrection at the Capitol. So I think the crisis has a lot to do with Biden's willingness to be bold and to be big. And if you want to be bold and you want to be big, well, all those ideas are coming from the left wing of the party.
And finally, what exactly is the Democratic Party? Is it a brand, a franchising operation, an affinity group, a federation of 50 state organizations? It's really hard to see a coherent structure there. Obama intervened to get Biden the nomination in last February. That showed some discipline, but it was him personally leading things, not really the party structure. So how would you summarize the structure of this party?
Well, yeah, two excellent party scholars and friends of mine, Danny Schlossman and Sam Rosenfeld, have a great phrase. Now, they apply this to both American political parties, which I'm a little skeptical of. But what is for sure is that the Democratic Party is a hollow party. It is a brand, and it has a discernible structure, but that structure is hollow, right? It has surface area without much guts to it. And the Republican Party is a little different. It's much more well organized. It's much more of a well-oiled machine. It has robust grassroots organization that is the legacy of those presidents that I mentioned before, making systematic investments in building out the party over the last half century. But the Democratic Party is hollow, and it is an organization that draws together office holders and activists. And they often don't see eye to eye. So there's a contention. There's a set of contentious relationships at the heart of this party. Activists wanted to do X. Politicians wanted to do Y. Sometimes they see eye to eye, but it's always going to be a contentious negotiation. And sometimes that negotiation spills out into disruptive protest or chaotic conventions, or it's fought out in primary elections between Joe Biden and his supporters, such as they were, and Bernie and his supporters. But it is ultimately what I conclude, it is an arena that is open to contestation. And I think a lot of what we're seeing right now and what I try and show in the book is that American political parties are pretty frustrating institutions if you want to see dramatic change in the world. But they're also pretty flexible. They can change, and they do change pretty dramatically over time. They change for a lot of reasons. There's contending forces that are pushing and pulling them to change in multiple directions all at once, but change they ultimately do. And I think one of the things we're seeing right now that we haven't seen for a long time is that the left, broadly construed, is transforming the Democratic Party. What it becomes, ultimately, how long this transformation can be sustained, I don't know. But the unprecedented burst of progressive policymaking we're seeing coming out of the White House now in the Congress, I think is a reflection of that.
At moments, it seems like we're seeing a rerun of the 70s, where that progressive forces were really pushing the party to transform its politics. Are we going to see a rerun of the turn to the right again in a few years?
You know, I don't think so. I do think the similarities to the 1970s are apt in that I also think, to make a little bit more of a controversial statement, is I think neoliberalism is pretty much done. I think neoliberalism was mortally wounded in the 2008 crisis. There is, compared to the 90s, there is no uncritical celebration of free markets and free trade and liberalization anymore that I hear, not in American politics anyway. And even the Republican Party has, while I think probably there's plenty of people in that party who still want neoliberalism to be alive, that party is now in the firm grip of a reactionary populism that doesn't, I think, care at all about free market conservatism. So what is emerging is hard to say, but I think there are good indications that the Democratic Party is breaking from its neoliberal past, moving towards some kind of maybe American-style social democracy. I don't know how long that's going to be sustained or whether the Democratic Party can consolidate a new kind of order in the way that, you know, Reagan and Clinton consolidated neoliberalism. I don't know that Biden is going to be consolidating any kind of new order at that level. We may just be in a period of extended flux.
That was the second part of my interview with Adam Hilton, author of True Blues, The Contentious Transformation of the Democratic Party, just out from the University of Pennsylvania Press. We discussed the Democratic Party's losses at the sub-presidential level under Obama. They were quite substantial. At the beginning of his term in 2009, Dems controlled 59% of state legislatures. When he left office 8 years later, they controlled 31%. When Obama was inaugurated, the Democrats held 29 governor's offices. When he departed to go sailing with Richard Branson, they had 16, the lowest number since 1920. Obama entered office with his party controlling 60 seats in the Senate. He left with them holding 48. They went from 257 House seats, a solid majority, to 194, a weak minority. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this. Some of This Funeral is for the Wrong Corpse by the Mekons. I play this song fairly often, but it has been 2 years, so I deem that a decent interval. Till next week, bye. Cemetery. What you call a sane man is now an impotent man.